Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Bennington, Vermont. This talk, presented on Sunday, August 25th, 2024, is by Naomi Miller on the topic of hope.
Before the events with Biden and Harris, before that switch, Joan suggested that really what we all need to think about right now is hope. And this recent week sort of stole that thunder. I'm not going to try to repeat any of the joys that we were bombarded with. But it made me sort of journey back in the psychology literature that I'm most familiar with to help think about how one achieves and maintains hope. Because that is, aside from our present national situation, it's so hard to maintain hope in the face of everything that's happening. And it seems clear to me as I think about it, and I'm sure we all know this, but I don't know if we ever think about it, that there are really two kinds of hope. And one is a fantasy-based hope. It's a wish fulfillment hope. It's a sort of hysterical hope, you know? And the other is a realism-based hope. Of course, there are more kinds than that, but on the whole. And it's that realism-based hope that's hardest to hold on to at times when the immediate reality looks pretty grim. So I started looking in the psych literature about hope, and first of all the way back in 1880, a very early American psychologist, J.F. Clark, wrote a paper called Education of Hope. And in it, he framed that sort of dualism around hope, I thought, really well. He said, there are two kinds of hope, an elusive hope, a will-o'-the-wisp which comes from an excited imagination, and a substantial hope born from experience, tears, and wrongs. So then I began to think, how is it that some of us sometimes are able to work what he called experience, tears, and wrongs into substantial hope? And it made me think in turn about one of my favorite Freud quotes. He wrote, next to the exigencies of life, love is the greatest teacher. The exigencies of life in love and hope. So I was thinking about love and hope and exigencies of life. It seems to me that love teaches us by taking us out of ourselves, leading us to put someone else's welfare on a par with our own or more. And the enduring exigencies of life teach us by forcing us into a patience. And Clark talked about patience too. And the patience with the exigencies of life, if we stick with them, forms the basis for an understanding of tears and wrongs in a broad way, a way that can build hope, that takes us beyond the immediate exigencies. What Clark called a substantial hope is one that's based in realism. And I think it's not the statistical likelihood of a specific outcome kind of realism, but the kind that recognizes the vast variety of possible outcomes and remains open to that variety in a sort of patient way that allows us to really imagine that we might not be at the center of the story, and that there might be possible events that are going to happen that might be reason for hope, but that are way beyond what we in our own narrow selves can imagine. I mean, that's realism. It's not deciding exactly what's realistic in the moment. It's an actual hope that may go beyond what you can imagine right now. And that made me think about something that's often discussed here, usually sort of passingly, which is the existence of morality without religion. People were talking about it when Bill talked a couple of weeks ago. A morality that's based in something other than externally structured rules or laws. Because I'm thinking that the same essential things are probably required for that kind of morality that's not based in religious laws as are required for having and maintaining substantial hope. Both of these things are necessary for us right now. The capacity to have hope without illusion and the capacity to have a morality that transcends any one set of cultural or religious laws. So, wondering what's required for these things? Am I still making sense to people? Okay. Wondering what... I also have been sort of sleep-deprived this week, and I'm wondering what's required for these things led me to think about the work of two other psychologists who many of you will have heard about, and I'm sorry for being repetitive. But first, Jean Piaget's work on cognitive development I thought might be helpful to answer the question, how do we achieve the cognitive approach that allows us to learn from the exigencies of life and to turn experience, tears, and wrongs into hope? And second, Lawrence Kohlberg's work on moral development to answer the question, how do we achieve and maintain a morality that transcends specific cultural laws and that leads to altruistic behavior? Which I see is very tied to hope. So, I'm going to very much oversimplify this, of course, but Piaget found that as humans develop through childhood and adolescence, they develop different ways of thinking as they move towards adulthood. And he identified four general stages. In the first stage, about birth to two, babies, they learn about the world through their senses. That's their thing, right? In the second stage, about two to seven, when children have miraculously learned to speak, they've learned language, they begin to learn about the world not only by doing but by talking, and by talking about what they're doing, and by talking about what they could do. So they spend a lot of cognitive energy learning to label the world. In the third stage, about 7 to 12, children learn to use language to maneuver the concrete world. They play a lot of games of what if, and let's pretend that, and they spend a lot of time arguing about those what-ifs and those hypotheticals, yeah? When we say that someone is a concrete thinker, we can all think of some concrete thinkers, right? We're talking about a person who's rooted in that stage of cognitive development, stays there, with hypotheticals that are about what they can see, touch, taste, feel. But what Piaget identified as the fourth stage of cognitive development, which he called formal operations, involves the ability to think comparatively about things that are not physically present. While most humans develop this capacity to some degree by the age of 14 or 15, the capacity is just not stable in at least half of people who've been studied across cultures. So it can't be relied on. Almost everybody can think hypothetically and can think in abstraction about things that are not here, and then can derive new thoughts from those hypotheticals that were in themselves abstract, you know, a sort of double layer of abstraction. By the age of 14 or so, most people can, but not everybody does. And when something has to do with something that evokes a lot of emotion, it becomes harder to stay in that abstract analytical realm, and the capacity for formal operational thinking plummets for many people when they're talking about something or thinking about something that is upsetting or in which they have a great emotional stake. Our last president played on that a lot. Right? Sent a lot of rational people into an inability to think rationally by sort of hitting certain emotional places. Sticking with abstraction, even in the face of strong emotion, requires, in other words, not just the cognitive ability, but it requires practice, and it can be taught. So anybody who's been involved in the educational world in the last 25 years is familiar with the phrase critical thinking, right? And we start to try to teach that now in high school, which is that age when people become able to engage in critical thinking. And we continue to try to teach it through college. And unfortunately, we continue to try to teach it through graduate school because it's really hard for people to do on a regular basis. But the more you practice it, the better you get at it. And one of the problems is that not all human situations provide people with the potential for that practice. This leads me to Lawrence Kohlberg. Because I think you can see how immediately, right, how the capacity for formal operational thinking is what enables you to make moral judgments at a certain kind of level. But let me just walk us briefly through Kohlberg's stages. And I have to say that Lawrence Kohlberg was critiqued extensively and very profitably, particularly by Carol Gilligan, who I recommend as a wonderful source to read. Interesting feminist psychologist. Lots of problems with Kohlberg's research based on his gender biases, but his basic stages do provide a sort of understanding of how a useful framework, and they've held up. So he identified three basic stages of moral development. And he derived these stages from telling a variety of children several different stories, and then that had sort of moral questions raised in them, and asking the kids questions about the story afterwards. So his most famous story was the Heinz and the Druggist story. Familiar to anybody? Couple of people. So here's the Heinz and the Druggist story. Heinz was a working class man who had a wife who he loved very deeply, and she got cancer, and she was going to die unless she got a certain medicine. The doctor told Hines to go to the drugstore and get the medicine. Hines went to the drugstore and was told that the medicine cost $2,000. Hines didn't have $2,000. That's the story. And the question that Kohlberg posed to children of different ages was, should Hines steal the drug? So in the first stage of moral reasoning that Kohlberg called preconventional, and sort of in early childhood, kids base their moral reasoning on avoiding punishment or gaining rewards. So kids in that stage say, no, he shouldn't steal the drug. He might get caught. Clear, very clear. In the second stage, reasoning is based on rigid codes of law and order. And this is where about half of humans stop, incidentally. These kids say very clearly, no, he should not steal the drug because that's against the law. Stealing is wrong. In the third stage, reasoning is based on abstract ethical principles. So kids in that stage, and I always can imagine a sort of like earnest 12-year-old boy with glasses, say things like, yes, Hines should steal the drug because we value life more than we value property. Of course, if our law said that, it would be really a good thing. It doesn't, but... So this post-conventional moral reasoning, that's what Kohlberg labeled it, seems to me to be what we need in order to work Clark's tears and wrongs into a substantial hope. Rather than being sucked into the vortex of blame and revenge that we are surrounded with and drawn into. And to achieve this kind of moral reasoning, one does need to think in what Piaget called a formal operational way. Abstractly, hypothetically, analytically. Because life does bring us tears and wrongs, holding on to a realism-based hope requires us to be able to process these hurts abstractly, contextualize them flexibly, and be able that way to hold on to feelings of love for other people. And what a surprise. I'm going to circle back to Freud. Unfairly maligned and misunderstood and underread. So, in 1931, facing Nazism's rise, he ended his last book, Civilization and Its Discontents, with a paragraph that's famous for the fact that it has seemed to deepen in its resonance with whatever moment we were in every moment since 1931. He wrote, "The fateful question for the human species seems to me to be whether and to what extent their cultural development will succeed in mastering the disturbance of their communal life by the human instinct of aggression and self-destruction," which he called Thanatos. "It may be," he wrote, "that in this respect, precisely the present time deserves a special interest. Men have gained control over the forces of nature to such an extent that with their help they would have no difficulty in exterminating one another to the last man. They know this, and hence comes a large part of their current unrest, their unhappiness, and their mood of anxiety. And now it is to be expected that the other of the two heavenly powers, eternal Eros, will make an effort to assert himself in the struggle with his equally immortal adversary. But who can foresee with what success and with what result?